Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writer Series, Friday, November 1st, 2002. I'm speaking with Judith Kerman, who is a professor of English, Humanities, and Web Design at Saginaw Valley State University. Welcome to MSU, Dr. Kerman.
Thank you.
Well, having taught at several colleges and having founded Midland's Mayapple Press, you've worn many different hats in your career.
Not Midland.
Oh, sorry, not
Midland. Actually, and I was an administrator in most of the places where I worked.
Oh, okay.
So maybe it's worth starting over on those two points.
Okay. Go on.
Okay.
But you've been a teacher, writer, editor, and publisher. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite role, if you can decide on one?
I can't have a favorite role.
Okay.
I am the person who is happiest mm-hmm. with, well, let's put it this way. If I have to choose between being bored and being crazy, I always pick crazy, so I must prefer it.
That's why you always have
I liked administration. I liked teaching. Having just come back from a Fulbright mm-hmm. and discovered that immense pleasure of having time to read having time to pursue personal projects. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I'll get that before I retire, but that certainly was fun.
Oh, good. Well, speaking of your Fulbright, mm-hmm. you just lived in the Dominican Republic from January through July of this year as a Fulbright senior researcher and lecturer. You taught at the University in Santo Domingo?
I taught at Universidad Iberoamericana, but yes. I really only did one course. The rector was interested in supporting my translation work, mm-hmm. so he made time for that. And I also ended up doing a major web page for the Anthropology Museum, the National Anthropology Museum.
Yeah, I saw that. Couldn't read it. Not much of it anyway.
But you could look at the pictures.
But yes, and anthropology is one of my undergraduate degrees, so I have profound interest in that.
It is a world-class collection.
Yes, well, good. What led you to decide to apply for a Fulbright at this point in your career?
Well, it's really a question of what led me into working in Spanish and doing translation at all, perhaps.
Good.
I've always been interested in languages, although I never really thought I had any talent for them. Mm-hmm. I had 6 years of French in junior high and high school, and I figured, well, you know, anybody who has 6 years obviously is going to have a usable amount of the language. I now know that isn't true, but I thought so. When I was invited to go to Germany for a study tour, I sat down with the book and I got tapes, and I learned about a semester's worth of German more or less on my own in 6 weeks. And I thought, oh my goodness, I can actually learn languages. I'm systematic about it. I understood how the resources I already had. Mm-hmm. I'm a musician. I have a good ear. I'm a writer and an English teacher, and I have an intuitive sense of linguistic structure, although not much in the way of formal linguistic training. Mm-hmm. But what I really wanted to do, and I guess I wanted to do that for a long time, was live somewhere where they didn't speak English and really get another language.
Yeah.
And in 91, I took a course in Spanish at my university mm-hmm. and kind of psyched myself up for it by going to Mexico during Thanksgiving break of that semester mm-hmm. and liked Spanish. And so my vice president and I arranged, because I had some vacation time accrued, for me to spend 6 weeks in Mexico in 93. So that was my second hit of Spanish. And I went to Institutos de Idiomas, which you do 4 hours of formal instruction a day and you live with a family, and in Cuernavaca and Morelia in Mexico. And it's the best way to learn a language.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly if you're an outgoing person.
Yeah.
You go into the mercado and you talk to the taxi drivers and you talk to the senora in the house who doesn't, even if she speaks English, she's not supposed to speak it with you because you're there to study Spanish. And during that 4 weeks, in the second half of that 4 weeks in Morelia, probably the week when I could read, you mm-hmm. know, I could look at a word like mirándolo and know that it was a particular form of the verb and find it in the dictionary and find out what it was. Mm-hmm. That week, I stumbled on a writer's workshop in the bookstore down the street from my school. And the person who was leading the workshop was reading from Dulce María Loynas to his group to give some examples of how to do some kinds of things, and also mm-hmm. a couple of Mexican poets. And I did a little bit of translation from one of the Mexican poets and did some translations of Loynas. It was like I could understand. I mean, I couldn't really understand, but I sort mm-hmm. of got the impression. I'm almost sure he was reading from The Last Days of a House, because I had this impression of an empty house. Well, mm-hmm. it has to have been that.
Yeah.
I picked up his book while he was talking with the group and spontaneously started translating a couple of poems. which are in my collection, as a matter of fact. Translations are in my collection. And after I got home, I decided that translating was a very good way to stay in the language. And that between a 90-year, at that point, 90-some-year-old mm-hmm. Cuban woman that nobody in the States apparently knew about, except maybe people in Miami, because the Spanish literature people on my campus had never heard of her. But she won the Cervantes, and so she was important. And I figured there would be magazine publications possible with those translations, because she was inherently interesting. And the work was very exciting. And so I started translating her. And then my friend said, oh, you should go meet her. And I said, what are you talking about? You can't go to Cuba. They said, sure, you can go to Cuba. Mm-hmm. We bet you can go to Cuba. Well, it turned out I could. And in 96, I went twice. And I met her. I was there for her 94th birthday party. And I had her blessing for my work. I read some of the translations for her. I made a little special handmade book of some of the poems. Yes. And I started looking for a publisher for a collection. And so it all sort of evolved out of just being interested in learning languages and then Spanish. And basically, since 91, I have been in the language for a week or two every year. I've been corresponding by email with some Cuban friends who live in Spain, doing the translations, and one way or another, building my language. And I'm probably now, after 7 months in the Dominican Republic, a little better than an intermediate level student. But I function much better than that because I talk to people. And, you know, when I came back from the DR, I would say, now I understand it better than I speak it. It used to be I spoke it better than I understood it. But, you know, a lot of people think that a translator must be expert in the literature and expert in the language. And that's not the case. And, in fact, when I have an anthology of Dominican women that's in press. And I had some trouble writing my translator's introduction because I was so aware that this is what people think. And I had to really deal with the fact that it's not right. And that's where I started that introduction. To be a competent translator, first, you need to be a good poet in the recipient language. And then you either need to be a competent reader or you need to have help. But there are lots of translators who don't know the languages, the original languages of what they translate. They work with people who give them not just, you can't just get roughs, because the problem of translation is that there is no exact translation for many things. So I was able to read with a lot of interference from my from the weaknesses of my language skills. And that's still sort of true. I picked up a book in the DR, a collection of short stories, and I'm reading it. And I miss a lot of words, but I'm at the point now where I can plow on through and get what the story's about if I'm willing to do that. And I hope I can get to the point where I can just read for pleasure that way and not feel frustrated all the time.
Yes.
But for translating, I enter a kind of space in which the poem is neither one language nor the other. And you can do that with Dulce María Loynaz because she's a very classical writer. Her Spanish is very pure and very classical. And she doesn't often do complicated things with the syntax, where the poem depends on things that are really not content, but something about structure. I'm thinking about an American poet like Robert Creeley. There's no, it's all bones. I don't mean that in a negative sense, but his poems are pure structure. And it's more than just knowing what each word means or what each sentence means. It also is understanding something about the relationship between what he's trying to do and the structure of his language. And I don't think that that's true of Dulce. Now that I've done contemporary Cuban and contemporary Dominican poets, where it's sometimes much harder because people fracture the imagery. It's either postmodern or surrealist, kind of depending on who it is that you're working with. But it's hard to say that a line like this, a line from one of the Dominican poets, the squid smiles maliciously at the aloe, or maybe vice versa. But I mean, like, what's that? But that is what the line says. That is what the line says. So you don't even know for sure that you've understood what the line says. Most of the time, that is not a problem with Dulce. So I don't think it's an accident that I started translating with her, because she was penetrable for me, even at the beginning. And the hard thing for her, I'm not saying she's easy to translate. The hard thing in translating her is getting the tone right.
Yes.
Because that classical Spanish, if you just do a literal translation, it's very clunky English.
Yeah. You really have to work with the rhythm,
and you have to allow it to be more compressed
mm-hmm.
and in some ways more colloquial in English than it is in Spanish for it to feel okay. right in English. But that's how I got started with all of that stuff. So when it came time, some of my colleagues at Saginaw Valley
mm-hmm.
were successful in applying for Fulbrights. And, you know, we're a comprehensive two university. We're not a research university. We're not
mm-hmm.
used to thinking of ourselves in terms of things like Fulbrights. But yes. several people got them, and the administration was encouraging people to apply. And for me, question one was a Spanish language country.
Mm-hmm.
This was what I had wanted to do, and here was a chance to do it. And then question two, a place with a reasonably stable and reasonably non-oppressive government. And that
mm-hmm.
wiped out a bunch of places.
Yeah.
And then I realized I have an investment in the Spanish Caribbean.
Yes.
With the Cuban work.
Mm-hmm.
I have a track record.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the book was in press with White Pine. And there are only three countries in the Spanish Caribbean, at least the island countries, if
yes.
you don't count some of the countries that are on the mainland along the shore, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no Fulbrights for Cuba or Puerto Rico. So this was very
process
logical.
Process of elimination.
Right.
Yeah.
And I proposed to translate their women because
mm-hmm.
when I was in Mexico and Cuernavaca in one of my
mm-hmm.
language trips, I went to the Biblioteca Octavio Paz, which has a very good Latin American poetry collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that all the anthologies were overwhelmingly men. That it was like there were no important women poets
sure.
in the Dominican Republic except Salome Oreña and Aida Cartagena Portalatin. Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Where have I seen this pattern before?
Yeah, exactly.
And there was a book there, Sin Otro Profeto Que Su Canto, with no other prophet than their song,
mm-hmm.
by Daisy Coco de Filippis, who teaches at City University of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a overtly feminist project to make the women poets, the contemporary women poets, visible.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me my list of people I wanted to interview.
Oh, good.
And apparently the U.S. Embassy and the people who were consulting with them for the Dominican Fulbrights thought that was a worthwhile project, because I'm quite sure that that's why they gave me the award.
Good.
And so I'm coming back with two books in press.
Mm-hmm. And congratulations.
Thank you. And they're impressed there. And they'll be published in
yes.
the Dominican Republic. One is Eight Dominican Poets, Women.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is something I didn't expect to do. It's 16 short stories
mm-hmm.
by Ilma Contreras, who won the National Literature Prize this year, the first woman ever, at the age of 92.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's a very strange, sort of a fabulist.
Mm-hmm.
They're very short stories, which is one reason I was willing to undertake them, because fiction kind of intimidates me even now.
Yeah.
But some of the poems I've done of Dulces,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I'm going to read tonight is La Novia de Lázaro, an example of the kind of word that's hard to translate. Novia
mm-hmm.
can be boyfriend, girlfriend, can be bride.
Oh.
So if you say, es mi novio, if I'm saying that's my boyfriend,
yes.
or it could be that's my fiancé.
Yes.
And La Novia de Lázaro presumes that Lazarus, the one who was resurrected
mm-hmm.
by Jesus, had a girlfriend or a fiancé.
Mm-hmm.
She refers to herself as a bride.
Oh, okay.
So one of the problems right off is, what do we call this poem in English?
Sure.
There's no equivalent word. Fiancé is impossibly arch.
Mm-hmm.
I said sweetheart, but various of my native speaking Spanish language friends said that was really too loose.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up with bride, because for this poem, that really is appropriate.
Yes.
And yet, it narrows it too much. There's something about novia
sure.
that is less legalistic in a funny
mm-hmm.
sort of way than to call it bride.
But you really can't begin to convey that complexity
right.
in the translation.
That's right. I think the translation of the whole poem
mm-hmm.
is a pretty good capture of what goes
okay.
on in the Spanish. But the title is a compromise.
A little misleading, maybe.
It's a compromise.
Okay. Well, switching slightly to your work in Cuba, you have had some poems published by Ediciones Villa in
mm-hmm.
a magazine that they've produced. That's the famed book artist cooperative in Matanzas, Cuba. How did you first get involved with them?
Well, I found one of their books in the bookstore of the Casa de las Americas. I found a little funky is not even quite the right word for it, a little book, which was a children's puppet play about Iku and Alegua, two of the figures in the Santeria pantheon. And it was charming. You know, there was a little bookmark made out of, I guess it was hemp or jute string, with a cutout of Alegua on it, you know, cut out of cardboard with his face. It was done on a mimeograph machine. I think this was the first trip, but it might have been the second. I went out there. It must have been the second. I went out to see them in Matanzas, which means you have to find somebody to drive you out because public transportation is almost a non-thing between cities. And met Zaldivar and saw the legendary Czechoslovak mimeograph machines. They had two, one they used for parts and the other one they printed their books on. And now they have Xerox and it's a bit more up to date. But the basic aesthetic, I mean, I was interested because I make books.
Sure.
And the idea of these exquisite things, really, made out of essentially brown paper bag materials and string. And some of the early ones in my collection, you really can't read because the mimeograph is just not clear enough.
Yeah.
And particularly if they're handwritten onto a stencil. But they're really beautiful, elegant, conceptually very exciting objects.
Yes, MSU has one of the largest collections of Ehia books.
At the time that I visited them, they were working on the edition of the Revista that was going to be dedicated to Dulce's work. And I gave them some, I faxed them some translations after I got back to my hotel. And I was never sure whether they had done them or not, because I never got a copy until I went back last year.
Oh, okay.
And then I went and visited them again, and Augustina dug me up maybe the last copy that anybody could get so that I would have one. Well, that one was in the show here.
Well, that had to be a thrill then.
Oh, yeah.
Well, switching gears a little, in 1991 you edited a volume of essays entitled Retrofitting Blade Runner, Issues in Ridley Scott's Blade Runner and Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And in your bio you noted that you were active in the scholarship of the fantastic. Right. How'd you end up becoming interested in and writing about those issues? Sci-fi and related topics?
Well, I follow my nose a lot.
Okay.
And in the case of... Well, I guess I did that book before I got involved with the International Conference on the Fantastic and the Arts. Okay. But I've always been a science fiction reader. And when I was in grad school, I was grad assistant to Samuel R. Delaney, who's a major science fiction writer. And that sort of encouraged me a little bit. But when I went to Kent State working as an administrator, they have they host one of the science fiction research journals. And there were several people, one of whom worked in my office. Colleague who were science fiction scholars, and so I found out how to do it. At one of the conferences, which I think was probably Popular Culture Association, I heard a whole bunch of Blade Runner papers, and I had just given a Blade Runner paper that grew out of my fascination with the difference in feel between the film, which I was absolutely stunned by, and the original Philip K. Dick book, which I admire but don't really like. The experience is just not one that I enjoy as much. But I got interested in why they felt so different.
Yeah.
It appeared that the storylines were the same, although that's not quite true. But the flavor, the emotional experience, the gestalt were very different. So I started writing, and it was very early in my career as a writer of academic papers, I guess you'd have to say, was a paper about the sort of the semiotics of Blade Runner and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and how a little bit of a semiotic approach could help explain why these experiences were so different. And then the following year, as I gave another paper, and I saw papers all over the place about either Philip K. Dick or Blade Runner at this PCA conference and at science fiction research conferences, I realized there was a book there. And I went to talk to Pat Brown at Popular Press and Bowling Green, and sold her the idea. And my argument was, and it is really the argument that the introduction to the book makes, that the question of how we treat other entities that are not biologically the same as human beings, but that are arguably sentient, is really at the center of some very important questions in 20th century world politics. Because what we do, what we human beings do time after time, and you see it to this day, in order to justify mistreating someone, whether it is the way whites treated blacks when they justified slavery, mm-hmm. whether it's the way the Nazis treated the Jews, whether it's the way Israelis and Palestinians talk about each other,
yeah.
is to say they're not really human.
Yeah.
They don't have human feelings. Therefore, dot, 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 mm-hmm. you can do whatever you want. And it seemed to me that that's what Blade Runner and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep
yeah.
are about. That's why this empathy thing,
yeah.
which is one of Philip K. Dick's particular ideas, is so important.
Yeah.
Because finally, that's what makes us treat other people as equal in moral importance to mm-hmm. ourselves, is that we see their pain and our pain mm-hmm. In the cycle, in the philosophical sense of it, as somehow equivalent. The minute we say that's not a human being,
yeah.
we have made that no longer an issue. They don't feel pain the way
sure.
we do.
Well, perhaps you don't like the novel as much as the movie because the novel is clearly satire.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. The film is a great romance.
Mm-hmm.
and also...
Interesting one, yeah.
Also, I was fascinated, and I think a lot of people who really saw the film as the first great true science fiction mm-hmm. film, not just a space opera, but true
sure.
science fiction. It imagines the world in a way that feels complete.
Yeah.
Now, you can pick holes in it. One of the essays in my book is about how impossible that city is, for
yeah.
example. But from the point of view of kind of your reaction to what the cinematographer captures and the mise-en-scene,
mm-hmm.
it feels like a real place.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a real culture. And that, to me, was why this was the first truly science fiction great film.
Mm-hmm.
For all of the flaws in the storytelling and the holes
yeah.
in the story and all the rest of that. I think at the time some of us felt that the bar scene from mm-hmm. Star Wars, but only the bar scene, was the only other thing that came close.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
it's rich, it's dense.
Yeah.
And that's what's missing in most science fiction film.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of a complexity, a world that is as complex as reality is
mm-hmm.
in our emotional, in our intuitive understanding of it.
Yeah, I agree. Now, here's a little lighter question. We've got just a couple of quick questions left. But how did you get into clowning? And do you
it's
do other performance
It's a light
art?
Question, but not a light answer.
Oh, okay. Can you make it a short one?
Well, I will try. I have been on the edges of Jewish life
mm-hmm.
for a long time until about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I got much more serious about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a great teacher, Arthur Waskow, whom I have admired since he did the Freedom Seder back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a lecture in which he said that the Jews in Skokie, when the Nazis marched in Skokie, should have made Purim in the street. Now, to make Purim in the street is to have a clown party in which you sell, and precisely, Purim is the celebration of the victory
mm-hmm.
of loyalty and ethnic awareness over hatred.
Yeah.
That's what the story is about. And how do you celebrate Purim? Traditionally, you have a clown party. So the following year, I was living in Ann Arbor, and the following
mm-hmm.
year, the Nazis announced they were going to march in Ann Arbor
mm-hmm.
Against the communist influence, so-called, at the University of Michigan. And all of the religious community in Ann Arbor was up in arms.
Yeah.
And at my suggestion, several of us went in clown. And that was the beginning.
Very good.
I hope that was short enough.
No, that's fine. And now just one last question. It's just a standard one we ask. I mean, you've done so much of your work outside of Michigan, you know, especially your translation, obviously,
mm-hmm.
your Spanish literature and so forth. But what do you think living, teaching, working in Michigan has brought to your writing, your own writing?
Well, not just Michigan, but
mm-hmm.
I've lived within, as I like to say, at 100 miles of Lake Erie. For
okay.
most of my life since I went off to college in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
There
mm-hmm.
were 2 years back on the East Coast. The rest of the time, I've been in Michigan, I've been in Western New York, I've
okay.
been in Northern Pennsylvania near Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And the landscape is my landscape.
Oh, good.
And we're a more interesting and more culturally rich area of the country than a lot of people think.
Yeah.
May Apple Press, which is my small press,
mm-hmm.
well, the May Apple is a Great Lakes wild plant. I guess it exists in New York in the woods too, but
mm-hmm.
it's a northern U.S. wild plant. And I'm interested, to be honest with you, I am interested in helping to combat the idea that there is no culture that counts outside New York, Chicago, and San Francisco.
Good. Good, I'm glad. And you're dedicated in Mayapple Press to publishing Michigan writers.
Well, not just Michigan, but and I won't say like dedicated because I've published Californians even.
Yeah.
But I have a particular interest in women and Great Lakes because those are both, well, it's like somebody asked me in the Dominican Republic, are you translating men?
Yeah.
And I said, no. I said, it is true that Dominican men need help with world visibility too.
Yeah.
But on the whole, the men take care of each other.
Yes.
And the women need more help than the men do.
Good. Well,
and
thank
that's
you.
My job.
Thank you for doing that for us. But thank you very much, Dr. Kerman, for participating in the Michigan Writer Series. And good luck with your reading tonight. Good. Thank you.